1955. Tewodros embarked on a modernization of the state, creating a more centralized bureaucracy and judiciary, and a military capable of controlling the country and possibly fighting the Europeans. He placed military governors, responsible for collecting taxes and remitting them to him, in charge of all the provinces. His negotiations with European powers were difficult, and in exasperation, he imprisoned the English consul. In 1868, the English sent an expeditionary force, which sacked his capital. Tewodros committed suicide. All the same, Tewodros's reconstructed government did manage to pull off one of the great anti-colonial triumphs of the 19th century against the Italians. In 1889, the throne went to Menelik II, who was immediately faced with the interest of Italy in establishing a colony there. In 1885, the German Chancellor Bismarck had convened a conference in Berlin, where the European powers hatched the Scramble for Africa. That is, they decided how to divide up Africa into different spheres of interest. At the conference, Italy secured its rights to colonies in Eritrea, along the coast of Ethiopia and Somalia. Ethiopia, though not represented at the conference, somehow managed to survive intact. But the Italians still kept designs, and in 1896, they marched an army south from Eritrea. Menelik's response was similar to that of a European medieval king. He formed an army by getting the nobility to call up their armed men. This approach could not put an army in the field for long, but it could put a huge one together for a short time. This short time was just enough to defeat the Italians, whose 15,000 men were overwhelmed by Menelik's 100,000 in the Battle of Adowa in 1896. It was the most serious military defeat a pre-colonial African country was able to inflict on a European power, and secured Ethiopia's independence for another 40 years. The last emperor of Ethiopia, Rastafari, was crowned Haile Selassie in 1930. Haile Selassie ruled until he was overthrown by a second Italian invasion, which began in 1935, but he returned from exile with the help of the English in 1941. He then ruled until he was overthrown in a 1974 coup by the DERG, the Committee, a group of Marxist army officers who then proceeded to further impoverish and ravage the country. The basic extractive economic institutions of the absolutist Ethiopian Empire, such as Galt, and the feudalism created after the decline of Aksum, lasted until they were abolished after the 1974 revolution. Today, Ethiopia is one of the poorest countries in the world. The income of an average Ethiopian is about 1/40th that of an average citizen of England. Most people live in rural areas and practice subsistence agriculture. They lack clean water, electricity, and access to proper schools or health care. Life expectancy is about 55 years, and only 1/3 of adults are literate. A comparison between England and Ethiopia spans world inequality. The reason Ethiopia is where it is today is that, unlike in England, in Ethiopia, absolutism persisted until the recent past. With absolutism came extractive economic institutions and poverty for the mass of Ethiopians, though of course the emperors and nobility benefited hugely. But the most enduring implication of the absolutism was that Ethiopian society failed to take advantage of industrialization opportunities during the 19th and early 20th centuries, underpinning the abject poverty of its citizens today. The Children of Somali. Absolutist political institutions around the world impeded industrialization either indirectly, in the way they organized the economy, or directly, as we have seen in Austria-Hungary and Russia. But absolutism was not the only barrier to the emergence of inclusive economic institutions. At the dawn of the 19th century, many parts of the world, especially in Africa, lacked a state that could provide even a minimal degree of law and order, which is a prerequisite for having a modern economy. There was not the equivalent of Peter the Great in Russia, starting the process of political centralization and then forging Russian absolutism, let alone that of the Tudors in England, centralizing the state without fully destroying, or, more appropriately, without fully being able to destroy, the parliament and other constraints on their power. Without some degree of political centralization, even if the elites of these African polities had wished to greet industrialization with open arms, there wouldn't have been much they could have done. Somalia, situated in the Horn of Africa, illustrates the devastating effects of lack of political centralization. Somalia has been dominated historically by people organized into six clan families. The four largest of these, the Dir, Darod, Isak, and the Hawiye, all trace their ancestry back to a mythical ancestor, Somali. These clan families originated in the north of Somalia and gradually spread south and east, and are even today primarily pastoral people who migrate with their flocks of goats, sheep, and camels. In the south, the Digil and the Rahanwane, sedentary agriculturalists, make up the last two of the clan families. The territories of these clans are depicted on map 12. Somalis identify first with their clan family, but these are very large and contain many subgroups. First among these are clans that trace their descent back to one of the larger clan families. More significant are the groupings within clans called Diya paying groups, which consist of closely related kinspeople who pay and collect Diya or blood wealth compensation against the murder of one of their members. Somali clans and Diya paying groups were historically locked into almost continual conflict over the scarce resources at their disposal, particularly water sources and good grazing land for their animals. They also constantly raided the herds of neighboring clans and Diya-paying groups. Though clans had leaders called sultans and also elders, these people had no real power. Political power was very widely dispersed, with every Somali adult man being able to have his say on decisions that might affect the clan or group. This was achieved through an informal council made up of all adult males. There was no written law, no police, and no legal system to speak of, except that Sharia law was used as a framework within which informal laws were embedded. These informal laws for a Diya-paying group would be encoded in what was called a hir, a body of explicitly formulated obligations, rights, and duties the group demanded others obey in their interactions with the group. With the advent of colonial rule, these hirs began to be written down. For example, the Hassan Ugas lineage formed a Diya-paying group of about 1,500 men and was a subclan of the Dir clan family in British Somaliland. On March 8, 1950, their hir was recorded by the British District Commissioner, the first three clauses of which read, 1. When a man of the Hassan Ugas is murdered by an external group, 20 camels of his blood wealth, 100, will be taken by his next of kin, and the remaining 80 camels shared amongst all the Hassan Ugas. 2. If a man of the Hassan Ugas is wounded by an outsider and his injuries are valued at 33 1/3 camels, 10 camels must be given to him, and the remained to his Jifo group, a subgroup of the Diya group. 3. Homicide amongst members of the Hassan Ugas is subject to compensation at the rate of 33 1/3 camels, payable only to the deceased's next of kin. If the culprit is unable to pay all or part, he will be assisted by his lineage. The heavy focus of the hir on killing and wounding reflects the almost constant state of warfare between Diya-paying groups and clans. Central to this was blood wealth and blood feuding. A crime against a particular person was a crime against the whole Diya-paying group and necessitated collective compensation, blood wealth. If such blood wealth was not paid, the Diya-paying group of the person who had committed the crime faced the collective retribution of the victim. When modern transportation reached Somalia, blood wealth was extended to people who were killed or injured in motor accidents. The Hassan Ugas's here didn't refer only to murder. Clause 6 was, if one man of the Hassan Ugas insults another at a Hassan Ugas council, he shall pay 150 shillings to the offended party. In early 1955, the flocks of two clans, The Habar Tol Jalo and the Habar Yunis were grazing close to each other in the region of Dombareli. A man from the Yunis was wounded after a dispute with a member of the Tol Jalo over camel herding. The Yunis clan immediately retaliated, attacking the Tol Jalo clan and killing a man. This death led, following the code of blood wealth, to the Yunis clan offering compensation to the Tol Jalo clan, which was accepted. The blood wealth was to be handed over in person, as usual in the form of camels. At the handing over ceremony, one of the Tol Jalo killed a member of the Yunis, mistaking him for a member of the Diapaying group of the murderer. This led to all-out warfare, and within the next 48 hours, 13 Yunis and 26 Tol Jalo had been killed. Warfare continued for another year before elders from both clans, brought together by the English colonial administration, managed to broker a deal, the exchange of blood wealth, that satisfied both sides and was paid over the next 3 years. The paying of blood wealth took place in the shadow of the threat of force and feuding, and even when it was paid, it did not necessarily stop conflict. Usually, conflict died down and then flared up again. Political power was thus widely dispersed in Somali society, almost pluralistically. But without the authority of a centralized state to enforce order, let alone property rights, this led not to inclusive institutions. Nobody respected the authority of another, and nobody, including the British colonial state when it eventually arrived, was able to impose order. The lack of political centralization made it impossible for Somalia to benefit from the Industrial Revolution. In such a climate, it would have been unimaginable to invest in or adopt the new technologies emanating from Britain, or indeed to create the types of organizations necessary to do so. The complex politics of Somalia had even more subtle implications for economic progress. We mentioned earlier some of the great technological puzzles of African history. Prior to the expansion of colonial rule in the late 19th century, African societies did not use wheeled transportation or plow agriculture, and few had writing. Ethiopia did, as we have seen. The Somalis also had a written script, but unlike the Ethiopians, they did not use it. We have already seen instances of this in African history. African societies may not have used wheels or plows, but they certainly knew about them. In the case of the Kingdom of Congo, as we have seen, this was fundamentally due to the fact that the economic institutions created no incentives for people to adopt these technologies. Could the same issues arise with the adoption of writing? We can get some sense of this from the Kingdom of Tekale, situated to the northwest of Somalia, in the Nuba Hills of southern Sudan. The Kingdom of Tekale was formed in the late 18th century by a band of warriors led by a man called Ismail, and it stayed independent until amalgamated into the British Empire in 1884. The Tekale kings and people had access to writing in Arabic, but it was not used, except by the kings, for external communication with other polities and diplomatic correspondence. At first, this situation seems very puzzling. The traditional account of the origin of writing in Mesopotamia is that it was developed by states in order to record information, control people, and levy taxes. Wasn't the Tekale state interested in this? These questions were investigated by the historian Janet Ewald in the late 1970s as she tried to reconstruct the history of the Tekale state. Part of the story is that the citizens resisted the use of writing because they feared that it would be used to control resources, such as valuable land, by allowing the state to claim ownership. They also feared that it would lead to more systematic taxation. The dynasty that Ismail started did not gel into a powerful state. Even if it had wanted to, the state was not strong enough to impose its will over the objections of the citizens. But there were other, more subtle factors at work. Various elites also opposed political centralization, for example, preferring oral to written interaction with citizens because this allowed them maximum discretion. Written laws or orders could not be taken back or denied and were harder to change. They set benchmarks that governing elites might want to reverse. So neither the ruled nor the rulers of Tekale saw the introduction of writing to be to their advantage. The ruled feared how the rulers would use it, and the rulers themselves saw the absence of writing as aiding their quite precarious grip on power. It was the politics of Tikali that kept writing from being introduced. Though the Somalis had even less of a well-defined elite compared with the Tikali kingdom, it is quite plausible that the same forces inhibited their use of writing and their adoption of other basic technologies. The Somali case shows the consequences of the lack of political centralization for economic growth. The historical literature does not record instances of attempts to create such centralization in Somalia. However, it is clear why this would have been very difficult. To politically centralize would have meant that some clans would have been subject to the control of others, but they rejected any such dominance, and the surrender of their power that this would have entailed. The balance of military power in the society would also have made it difficult to create such centralized institutions. In fact, it is likely that any group or clan attempting to centralize power would not only have faced stiff resistance, but would have lost its existing power and privileges. As a consequence of this lack of political centralization and the implied absence of even the most basic security of property rights, Somali society never generated incentives to invest in productivity-enhancing technologies. As the process of industrialization was underway in other parts of the world in the 19th and early 20th centuries, Somalis were feuding and fending for their lives, and their economic backwardness became more ingrained. Enduring backwardness. The Industrial Revolution created a transformative critical juncture for the whole world during the 19th century and beyond. Those societies that allowed and incentivized their citizens to invest in new technologies could grow rapidly. But many around the world failed to do so, or explicitly chose not to do so. Nations under the grip of extractive political and economic institutions did not generate such incentives. Spain and Ethiopia provide examples where the absolutist control of political institutions and the implied extractive economic institutions choked economic incentives long before the dawn of the 19th century. The outcome was similar in other absolutist regimes, for example in Austria-Hungary, Russia, the Ottoman Empire, and China. Though in these cases the rulers, because of fear of creative destruction, not only neglected to encourage economic progress, but also took explicit steps to block the spread of industry and the introduction of new technologies that would bring industrialization. Absolutism is not the only form of extractive political institutions, and was not the only factor preventing industrialization. Inclusive political and economic institutions necessitate some degree of political centralization so that the state can enforce law and order, uphold property rights, and encourage economic activity when necessary by investing in public services. Yet even today, many nations such as Afghanistan, Haiti, Nepal, and Somalia have states that are unable to maintain the most rudimentary order, and economic incentives are all but destroyed. The case of Somalia illustrates how the process of industrialization also passed by such societies. Political centralization is resisted for the same reason that absolutist regimes resist change. The often well-placed fear that change will reallocate political power from those that dominate today to new individuals and groups. Thus, as absolutism blocks moves toward pluralism and economic change, so do the traditional elites and clans dominating the scene in societies without state centralization. As a consequence, societies that still lacked such centralization in the 18th and 19th centuries were particularly disadvantaged in the age of industry. While the variety of extractive institutions ranging from absolutism to states with little centralization failed to take advantage of the spread of industry, the critical juncture of the Industrial Revolution had very different effects in other parts of the world. As we will see in Chapter 10, societies that had already taken steps toward inclusive political and economic institutions, such as the United States and Australia, and those where absolutism was more seriously challenged, such as France and Japan, took advantage of these new economic opportunities and started a process of rapid economic growth. As such, the usual pattern of interaction between a critical juncture and existing institutional differences leading to further institutional and economic divergence played out again in the 19th century, and this time with an even bigger bang and more fundamental effects on the prosperity and poverty of nations. Chapter 9. Reversing Development. Spice and Genocide. The Moluccan archipelago in modern Indonesia is made up of three groups of islands. In the early 17th century, the northern Moluccas housed the independent kingdoms of Tidore, Ternate, and Bacan. The middle Moluccas were home to the island kingdom of Ambon. In the south were the Banda Islands, a small archipelago that was not yet politically unified. Though they seem remote to us today, the Moluccas were then central to world trade as the only producers of the valuable spices, cloves, mace, and nutmeg. Of these, nutmeg and mace grew only in the Banda Islands. Inhabitants of these islands produced and exported these rare spices in exchange for food and manufactured goods coming from the island of Java, from the entrepot of Malacca on the Malaysian Peninsula, and from India, China, and Arabia. The first contact the inhabitants had with Europeans was in the 16th century, with Portuguese mariners who came to buy spices. Before then, spices had to be shipped through the Middle East via trade routes controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Europeans searched for a passage around Africa or across the Atlantic to gain direct access to the Spice Islands and the spice trade. The Cape of Good Hope was rounded by the Portuguese mariner Bartolomeu Dias in 1488, and India was reached via the same route by Vasco da Gama in 1498. For the first time, the Europeans now had their own independent route to the Spice Islands. The Portuguese immediately set about the task of trying to control the trade in spices. They captured Malacca in 1511. Strategically situated on the western side of the Malaysian Peninsula, merchants from all over Southeast Asia came there to sell their spices to other merchants, Indian, Chinese, and Arabs, who then shipped them to the west. As the Portuguese traveler Tomé Pires put it in 1515, "The trade and commerce between the different nations for 1,000 leagues on every hand must come to Malacca. Whoever is lord of Malacca has his hands at the throat of Venice." With Malacca in their hands, the Portuguese systematically tried to gain a monopoly of the valuable spice trade. They failed. The opponents they faced were not negligible. Between the 14th and 16th centuries, there was a great deal of economic development in Southeast Asia based on trade in spices. City-states such as Aceh, Banten, Malacca, Makassar, Pegu, and Brunei expanded rapidly, producing and exporting spices along with other products such as hardwoods. These states had absolutist forms of government, similar to those in Europe in the same period. The development of political institutions was spurred by similar processes, including technological change in methods of warfare and international trade. State institutions became more centralized, with a king at the center claiming absolute power. Like absolutist rulers in Europe, Southeast Asian kings relied heavily on revenues from trade, both engaging in it themselves and granting monopolies to local and foreign elites. As in absolutist Europe, this generated some economic growth, but was a far from ideal set of economic institutions for economic prosperity, with significant entry barriers and insecure property rights for most. But the process of commercialization was underway, even as the Portuguese were trying to establish their dominance in the Indian Ocean. The presence of Europeans swelled and had a much greater impact with the arrival of the Dutch. The Dutch quickly realized that monopolizing the supply of the valuable spices of the Moluccas would be much more profitable than competing against local or other European traders. In 1600, they persuaded the ruler of Ambon to sign an exclusive agreement that gave them the monopoly on the clove trade in Ambon. With the founding of the Dutch East India Company in 1602, the Dutch attempts to capture the entire spice trade and eliminate their competitors, by hook or by crook, took a turn for the better for the Dutch and for the worse for Southeast Asia. The Dutch East India Company was the second European joint stock company, following the English East India Company, major landmarks in the development of the modern corporation, which would subsequently play a major role in European industrial growth. It was also the second company that had its own army and the power to wage war and colonize foreign lands. With the military power of the company now brought to bear, the Dutch proceeded to eliminate all potential interlopers to enforce their treaty with the ruler of Ambon. They captured a key fort held by the Portuguese in 1605 and forcibly removed all other traders. They then expanded to the northern Moluccas, forcing the rulers of Tidore, Ternate, and Bacan to agree that no cloves could be grown or traded in their territories. The treaty they imposed on Ternate even allowed the Dutch to come and destroy any clove trees they found there. Ambon was ruled in a manner similar to much of Europe and the Americas during that time. The citizens of Ambon owed tribute to the ruler and were subject to forced labor. The Dutch took over and intensified these systems to extract more labor and more cloves from the island. Prior to the arrival of the Dutch, extended families paid tribute in cloves to the Ambonese elite. The Dutch now stipulated that each household was tied to the soil and should cultivate a certain number of clove trees. Households were also obligated to deliver forced labor to the Dutch. The Dutch also took control of the Banda Islands, intending this time to monopolize mace and nutmeg. But the Banda Islands were organized very differently from Ambon. They were made up of many small autonomous city-states, and there was no hierarchical social or political structure. These small states, in reality no more than small towns, were run by village meetings of citizens. There was no central authority whom the Dutch could coerce into signing a monopoly treaty, and no system of tribute that they could take over to capture the entire supply of nutmeg and mace. At first, this meant that the Dutch had to compete with English, Portuguese, Indian, and Chinese merchants, losing the spices to their competitors when they did not pay high prices. Their initial plans of setting up a monopoly of mace and nutmeg dashed. The Dutch governor of Batavia, Jan Pieterszoon Koen, came up with an alternative plan. Koen founded Batavia, on the island of Java, as the Dutch East India Company's new capital in 1618. In 1621, he sailed to Banda with a fleet and proceeded to massacre almost the entire population of the islands, probably about 15,000 people. All their leaders were executed along with the rest, and only a few were left alive, enough to preserve the know-how necessary for mace and nutmeg production. After this genocide was complete, Koen then proceeded to create the political and economic structure necessary for his plan, a plantation society. The islands were divided into 68 parcels, which were given to 68 Dutchmen, mostly former and current employees of the Dutch East India Company. These new plantation owners were taught how to produce the spices by the few surviving Bandanese and could buy slaves from the East India Company to populate the now empty islands and to produce spices, which would have to be sold at fixed prices back to the company. The extractive institutions created by the Dutch in the Spice Islands had the desired effects, though. In Banda, this was at the cost of 15,000 innocent lives and the establishment of a set of economic and political institutions that would condemn the islands to underdevelopment. By the end of the 17th century, the Dutch had reduced the world supply of these spices by about 60%, and the price of nutmeg had doubled. The Dutch spread the strategy they perfected in the Moluccas to the entire region, with profound implications for the economic and political institutions of the rest of Southeast Asia. The long commercial expansion of several states in the area that had started in the 14th century went into reverse. Even the polities, which were not directly colonized and crushed by the Dutch East India Company, turned inward and abandoned trade. The nascent economic and political change in Southeast Asia was halted in its tracks. To avoid the threat of the Dutch East India Company, several states abandoned producing crops for export and ceased commercial activity. Autarky was safer than facing the Dutch. In 1620, the state of Banten on the island of Java cut down its pepper trees in the hope that this would induce the Dutch to leave it in peace. When a Dutch merchant visited Maguindanao in the southern Philippines in 1686, he was told, "Nutmeg and cloves can be grown here, just as in Malacca. They are not there now because the old Raja had all of them ruined before his death. He was afraid the Dutch company would come to fight with them about it." What a trader heard about the ruler of Maguindanao in 1699 was similar. He had forbidden the continued planting of pepper so that he could not thereby get involved in war, whether with the Dutch company or with other potentates. There was deurbanization and even population decline. In 1635, the Burmese moved their capital from Pegu on the coast to Ava, far inland up the Irrawaddy River. We do not know what the path of economic and political development of Southeast Asian states would have been without Dutch aggression. They may have developed their own brand of absolutism. They may have remained in the same state they were in at the end of the 16th century. Or they may have continued their commercialization by gradually adopting more and more inclusive institutions. But as in the Moluccas, Dutch colonialism fundamentally changed their economic and political development. The people in Southeast Asia stopped trading, turned inward, and became more absolutist. In the next two centuries, they would be in no position to take advantage of the innovations that would spring up in the Industrial Revolution. And ultimately, their retreat from trade would not save them from Europeans. By the end of the 18th century, nearly all were part of European colonial empires. We saw in Chapter 7 how European expansion into the Atlantic fueled the rise of inclusive institutions in Britain. But as illustrated by the experience of the Moluccas under the Dutch, this expansion sowed the seeds of underdevelopment in many diverse corners of the world by imposing or further strengthening existing extractive institutions. These either directly or indirectly destroyed nascent commercial and industrial activity throughout the globe, or they perpetuated institutions that stopped industrialization. As a result, as industrialization was spreading in some parts of the world, places that were part of European colonial empires stood no chance of benefiting from these new technologies. The all-too-usual institution. In Southeast Asia, the spread of European naval and commercial power in the early modern period curtailed a promising period of economic expansion and institutional change. In the same period as the Dutch East India Company was expanding, a very different sort of trade was intensifying in Africa, the slave trade. In the United States, Southern slavery was often referred to as the peculiar institution. But historically, as the great classical scholar Moses Finley pointed out, slavery was anything but peculiar. It was present in almost every society. It was, as we saw earlier, endemic in ancient Rome and in Africa, long a source of slaves for Europe, though not the only one. In the Roman period, slaves came from Slavic peoples around the Black Sea, from the Middle East, and also from Northern Europe. But by 1400, Europeans had stopped enslaving each other. Africa, however, as we saw in Chapter 6, did not undergo the transition from slavery to serfdom, as did medieval Europe. Before the early modern period, there was a vibrant slave trade in East Africa, and large numbers of slaves were transported across the Sahara to the Arabian Peninsula. Moreover, the large medieval West African states of Mali, Ghana, and Songhai made heavy use of slaves in the government, the army, and agriculture, adopting organizational models from the Muslim North African states with whom they traded. It was the development of the sugar plantation colonies of the Caribbean beginning in the early 17th century that led to a dramatic escalation of the international slave trade and to an unprecedented increase in the importance of slavery within Africa itself. In the 16th century, probably about 300,000 slaves were traded in the Atlantic. They came mostly from Central Africa, with heavy involvement of Congo and the Portuguese based farther south in Luanda, now the capital of Angola. During this time, the trans-Saharan slave trade was still larger, with probably about 550,000 Africans moving north as slaves. In the 17th century, the situation reversed. About 1,350,000 Africans were sold as slaves in the Atlantic trade, the majority now being shipped to the Americas. The numbers involved in the Saharan trade were relatively unchanged. The 18th century saw another dramatic increase, with about 6 million slaves being shipped across the Atlantic and maybe 700,000 across the Sahara. Adding the figures up over periods and parts of Africa, well over 10 million Africans were shipped out of the continent as slaves. Map 15 gives some sense of the scale of the slave trade. Using modern country boundaries, it depicts estimates of the cumulative extent of slavery between 1400 and 1900 as a percent of population in 1400. Darker colors show more intense slavery. For example, in Angola, Benin, Ghana, and Togo, total cumulative slave exports amounted to more than the entire population of the country in 1400. The sudden appearance of Europeans all around the coast of Western and Central Africa, eager to buy slaves, could not but have a transformative impact on African societies. Most slaves who were shipped to the Americas were war captives, subsequently transported to the coast. The increase in warfare was fueled by huge imports of guns and ammunition, which the Europeans exchanged for slaves. By 1730, about 180,000 guns were being imported every year just along the West African coast. And between 1750 and the early 19th century, the British alone sold between 283,000 and 394,000 guns a year. Between 1750 and 1807, the British sold an extraordinary 22,000 tons of gunpowder, making an average of about 384,000 kilograms annually, along with 91,000 kilograms of lead per year. Farther to the south, the trade was just as vigorous. On the Luango coast, north of the Kingdom of Congo, Europeans sold about 50,000 guns a year. All this warfare and conflict not only caused major loss of life and human suffering, but also put in motion a particular path of institutional development in Africa. Before the early modern era, African societies were less centralized politically than those of Eurasia. Most polities were small scale, with tribal chiefs and perhaps kings controlling land and resources. Many, as we showed with Somalia, had no structure of hierarchical political authority at all. The slave trade put in motion two adverse political processes. First, many polities initially became more absolutist, organized around a single objective, to enslave and sell others to European slavers. Second, as a consequence, but paradoxically in opposition to the first process, warring and slaving ultimately destroyed whatever order and legitimate state authority existed in sub-Saharan Africa. Apart from warfare, slaves were also kidnapped and captured by small-scale raiding. The law also became a tool of enslavement. No matter what crime you committed, the penalty was slavery. The English merchant Francis Moore observed the consequences of this along the Senegambia coast of West Africa in the 1730s. Since this slave trade has been used, all punishments are changed into slavery, there being an advantage on such condemnations. They strain for crimes very hard in order to get the benefit of selling the criminal. Not only murder, theft, and adultery are punished by selling the criminal for slave, but every trifling case is punished in the same manner. Institutions, even religious ones, became perverted by the desire to capture and sell slaves. One example is the famous oracle at Erochukwu in eastern Nigeria. The oracle was widely believed to speak for a prominent deity in the region respected by the major local ethnic groups, the Ija, the Ibibio, and the Igbo. The oracle was approached to settle disputes and adjudicate on disagreements. Plaintiffs who traveled to Erochukwu to face the oracle had to descend from the town into a gorge of the Cross River, where the oracle was housed in a tall cave, the front of which was lined with human skulls. The priests of the oracle, in league with the Aro slavers and merchants, would dispense the decision of the oracle. Often this involved people being swallowed by the oracle, which actually meant that once they had passed through the cave, they were led away down the Cross River and to the waiting ships of the Europeans. This process, in which all laws and customs were distorted and broken to capture slaves and more slaves, had devastating effects on political centralization. Though in some places it did lead to the rise of powerful states, whose main raison d'être was raiding and slaving. The Kingdom of Congo itself was probably the first African state to experience a metamorphosis into a slaving state, until it was destroyed by civil war. Other slaving states arose most prominently in West Africa, and included Oyo in Nigeria, Dahomey in Benin, and subsequently Asante in Ghana. The expansion of the state of Oyo in the middle of the 17th century, for example, is directly related to the increase of slave exports on the coast. The state's power was the result of a military revolution that involved the import of horses from the north and the formation of a powerful cavalry that could decimate opposing armies. As Oyo expanded south toward the coast, it crushed the intervening polities and sold many of their inhabitants for slaves. In the period between 1690 and 1740, Oyo established its monopoly in the interior of what came to be known as the Slave Coast. It is estimated that 80 to 90% of the slaves sold on the coast were the result of these conquests. A similar dramatic connection between warfare and slave supply came farther west in the 18th century, on the Gold Coast, the area that is now Ghana. After 1700, the state of Asante expanded from the interior in much the same way as Oyo had previously. During the first half of the 18th century, this expansion triggered the so-called Akan Wars, as Asante defeated one independent state after another. The last, Guyaman, was conquered in 1747. The preponderance of the 375,000 slaves exported from the Gold Coast between 1700 and 1750 were captives taken in these wars. Probably the most obvious impact of this massive extraction of human beings was demographic. It is difficult to know with any certitude what the population of Africa was before the modern period, but scholars have made various plausible estimates of the impact of the slave trade on the population. The historian Patrick Manning estimates that the population of those areas of West and West Central Africa that provided slaves for export was around 22 to 25 million in the early 18th century. On the conservative assumption that during the 18th and early 19th centuries, these areas would have experienced a rate of population growth of about 0.5% a year without the slave trade, Manning estimated that the population of this region in 1850 ought to have been at least 46 to 53 million. In fact, it was about 1/2 of this. This massive difference was not only due to about 8 million people being exported as slaves from this region between 1700 and 1850, but the millions likely killed by continual internal warfare aimed at capturing slaves. Slavery and the slave trade in Africa further disrupted family and marriage structures and may also have reduced fertility. Beginning in the late 18th century, a strong movement to abolish the slave trade began to gain momentum in Britain, led by the charismatic figure of William Wilberforce. After repeated failures in 1807, the abolitionists persuaded the British Parliament to pass a bill making the slave trade illegal. The United States followed with a similar measure the next year. The British government went further, though. It actively sought to implement this measure by stationing naval squadrons in the Atlantic to try to stamp out the slave trade. Though it took some time for these measures to be truly effective, and it was not until 1834 that slavery itself was abolished in the British Empire, the days of the Atlantic slave trade, by far the largest part of the trade, were numbered. Though the end of the slave trade after 1807 did reduce the external demand for slaves from Africa, this did not mean that slavery's impact on African societies and institutions would magically melt away. Many African states had become organized around slaving, and the British putting an end to the trade did not change this reality. Moreover, slavery had become much more prevalent within Africa itself. These factors would ultimately shape the path of development in Africa, not only before, but also after 1807. In the place of slavery came legitimate commerce, a phrase coined for the export from Africa of new commodities not tied to the slave trade. These goods included palm oil and kernels, peanuts, ivory, rubber, and gum arabic. As European and North American incomes expanded with the spread of the Industrial Revolution, demand for many of these tropical products rose sharply. Just as African societies took aggressive advantage of the economic opportunities presented by the slave trade, they did the same with legitimate commerce. But they did so in a peculiar context, one in which slavery was a way of life, but the external demand for slaves had suddenly dried up. What were all these slaves to do now that they could not be sold to Europeans? The answer was simple. They could be profitably put to work under coercion in Africa, producing the new items of legitimate commerce. One of the best documented examples was in Asante in modern Ghana. Prior to 1807, the Asante Empire had been heavily involved in the capturing and export of slaves, bringing them down to the coast to be sold at the great slaving castles of Cape Coast and Elmina. After 1807, with this option closed off, the Asante political elite reorganized their economy. However, slaving and slavery did not end. Rather, slaves were settled on large plantations, initially around the capital city of Kumasi, but later spread throughout the empire, corresponding to most of the interior of Ghana. They were employed in the production of gold and kola nuts for export, but also grew large quantities of food and were intensively used as porters, since Asante did not use wheeled transportation. Farther east, similar adaptations took place. In Dahomey, for example, the king had large palm oil plantations near the coastal ports of Whydah and Porto Novo, all based on slave labor. So the abolition of the slave trade, rather than making slavery in Africa wither away, simply led to a redeployment of the slaves, who were now used within Africa rather than in the Americas. Moreover, many of the political institutions the slave trade had wrought in the previous two centuries were unaltered and patterns of behavior persisted. For example, in Nigeria in the 1820s and 30s, the once great Oyo kingdom collapsed. It was undermined by civil wars and the rise of the Yoruba city-states such as Ilorin and Ibadan that were directly involved in the slave trade to its south. In the 1830s, the capital of Oyo was sacked, and after that, the Yoruba cities contested power with Dahomey for regional dominance. They fought an almost continuous series of wars in the first half of the century, which generated a massive supply of slaves. Along with this went the normal rounds of kidnapping and condemnation by oracles and smaller-scale raiding. Kidnapping was such a problem in some parts of Nigeria that parents would not let their children play outside for fear they would be taken and sold into slavery. As a result, slavery, rather than contracting, appears to have expanded in Africa throughout the 19th century. Though accurate figures are hard to come by, a number of existing accounts written by travelers and merchants during this time suggest that in the West African kingdoms of Asante and Dahomey, and in the Yoruba city-states, well over half of the population were slaves. More accurate data exists from early French colonial records for the Western Sudan, a large swath of Western Africa stretching from Senegal via Mali and Burkina Faso to Niger and Chad. In this region, 30% of the population was enslaved in 1900. Just as with the emergence of legitimate commerce, the advent of formal colonization, after the scramble for Africa, failed to destroy slavery in Africa. Though much of European penetration into Africa was justified on the grounds that slavery had to be combated and abolished, the reality was different. In most parts of colonial Africa, slavery continued well into the 20th century. In Sierra Leone, for example, It was only in 1928 that slavery was finally abolished, even though the capital city of Freetown was originally established in the late 18th century as a haven for slaves repatriated from the Americas. It then became an important base for the British anti-slavery squadron and a new home for freed slaves rescued from slave ships captured by the British Navy. Even with this symbolism, slavery lingered in Sierra Leone for 130 years. Liberia, just south of Sierra Leone, was likewise founded for freed American slaves in the 1840s. Yet there, too, slavery lingered into the 20th century. As late as the 1960s, it was estimated that one quarter of the labor force were coerced, living, and working in conditions close to slavery. Given the extractive economic and political institutions based on the slave trade, industrialization did not spread to sub-Saharan Africa, which stagnated or even experienced economic retardation as other parts of the world were transforming their economies. Making a dual economy. The dual economy paradigm, originally proposed in 1955 by Sir Arthur Lewis, still shapes the way that most social scientists think about the economic problems of less developed countries. According to Lewis, many less developed or underdeveloped economies have a dual structure and are divided into a modern sector and a traditional sector. The modern sector, which corresponds to the more developed part of the economy, is associated with urban life, modern industry, and the use of advanced technologies. The traditional sector is associated with rural life, agriculture, and backward institutions and technologies. Backward agricultural institutions include the communal ownership of land, which implies the absence of private property rights on land. Labor was used so inefficiently in the traditional sector, according to Lewis, that it could be reallocated to the modern sector without reducing the amount the rural sector could produce. For generations of development economists building on Lewis's insights, the problem of development has come to mean moving people and resources out of the traditional sector, agriculture, and the countryside, and into the modern sector, industry, and cities. In 1979, Lewis received the Nobel Prize for his work on economic development. Lewis and development economists building on his work were certainly right in identifying dual economies. South Africa was one of the clearest examples, split into a traditional sector that was backward and poor, and a modern one that was vibrant and prosperous. Even today, the dual economy Lewis identified is everywhere in South Africa. One of the most dramatic ways to see this is by driving across the border between the state of KwaZulu-Natal, formerly Natal, and the state of Transkei. The border follows the Great Kei River. To the east of the river in Natal, along the coast, are wealthy beachfront properties on wide expanses of glorious sandy beaches. The interior is covered with lush green sugarcane plantations. The roads are beautiful. The whole area reeks of prosperity. Across the river, it is as if it were a different time and a different country. The area is largely devastated. The land is not green, but brown and heavily deforested. Instead of affluent modern houses with running water, toilets, and all the modern conveniences, people live in makeshift huts and cook on open fires. Life is certainly traditional, far from the modern existence to the east of the river. By now, you will not be surprised that these differences are linked with major differences in economic institutions between the two sides of the river. On the east, in Natal, we have private property rights, functioning legal systems, markets, commercial agriculture, and industry. On the west, the Transkei had communal property in land and all-powerful traditional chiefs until recently. Looked at through the lens of Lewis's theory of dual economy, the contrast between the Transkei and Natal illustrates the problems of African development. In fact, we can go further and note that historically, all of Africa was like the Transkei, poor, with pre-modern economic institutions, backward technology, and rule by chiefs. According to this perspective, then, economic development should simply be about ensuring that the Transkei eventually turns into Natal. This perspective has much truth to it. but misses the entire logic of how the dual economy came into existence and its relationship to the modern economy. The backwardness of the Transkei is not just a historic remnant of the natural backwardness of Africa. The dual economy between the Transkei and Natal is in fact quite recent and is anything but natural. It was created by the South African white elites in order to produce a reservoir of cheap labor for their businesses and reduce competition from the black Africans. The dual economy is another example of underdevelopment created, not of underdevelopment as it naturally emerged and persisted over centuries. South Africa and Botswana, as we will see later, did avoid most of the adverse effects of the slave trade and the wars it wrought. South Africans' first major interaction with Europeans came when the Dutch East India Company founded a base in Table Bay, now the harbor of Cape Town, in 1652. At this time, the western part of South Africa was sparsely settled, mostly by hunter-gatherers called the Khoikhoi people. Farther east, in what is now the Ciskei and Transkei, there were densely populated African societies specializing in agriculture. They did not initially interact heavily with the new colony of the Dutch, nor did they become involved in slaving. The South African coast was far removed from slave markets, and the inhabitants of the Ciskei and Transkei, known as the Hossa, were just far enough inland not to attract anyone's attention. As a consequence, these societies did not feel the brunt of many of the adverse currents that hit West and Central Africa. The isolation of these places changed in the 19th century. For the Europeans, there was something very attractive about the climate and the disease environment of South Africa. Unlike West Africa, for example, South Africa had a temperate climate that was free of the tropical diseases such as malaria and yellow fever that had turned much of Africa into the white man's graveyard and prevented Europeans from settling or even setting up permanent outposts. South Africa was a much better prospect for European settlement. European expansion into the interior began soon after the British took over Cape Town from the Dutch during the Napoleonic Wars. This precipitated a long series of Hossa Wars as the settlement frontier expanded further inland. The penetration into the South African interior was intensified in 1834, when the remaining Europeans of Dutch descent, who would become known as Afrikaners or Boers, started their famous mass migration known as the Great Trek away from the British control of the coast and the Cape Town area. The Afrikaners subsequently founded two independent states in the interior of Africa, the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. The next stage in the development of South Africa came with the discovery of vast diamond reserves in Kimberley in 1867 and of rich gold mines in Johannesburg in 1886. This huge mineral wealth in the interior immediately convinced the British to extend their control over all of South Africa. The resistance of the Orange Free State and the Transvaal led to the famous Boer Wars in 1880-1881 and 1899-1902. After initial unexpected defeat, the British managed to merge the Afrikaner states with the Cape Province and Natal to found the Union of South Africa in 1910. Beyond the fighting between Afrikaners and the British, the development of the mining economy and the expansion of European settlement had other implications for the development of the area. Most notably, they generated demand for food and other agricultural products and created new economic opportunities for native Africans, both in agriculture and trade. The Hossa in the Ciskei and Transkei reacted quickly to these economic opportunities, as the historian Colin Bundy documented. As early as 1832, even before the mining boom, a Moravian missionary in the Transkei observed the new economic dynamism in these areas and noted the demand from the Africans for the new consumer goods that the spread of Europeans had begun to reveal to them. He wrote, "To obtain these objects, they looked to get money by the labor of their hands and purchase clothes, spades, plows, wagons, and other useful articles." The Civil Commissioner John Hemming's description of his visit to Fingoland in the Ciskei in 1876 is equally revealing. He wrote that he was struck with the very great advancement made by the Fingos in a few years. "Wherever I went, I found substantial huts and brick or stone tenements, In many cases, substantial brick houses had been erected, and fruit trees had been planted. Wherever a stream of water could be made available, it had been led out and the soil cultivated as far as it could be irrigated. The slopes of the hills and even the summits of the mountains were cultivated wherever a plow could be introduced. The extent of the land turned over surprised me. I have not seen such a large area of